I'm Kathleen Dunn. All things political coming up this hour. A busy news day or what? Ooh. First, James Comey, FBI director, is testifying before the House Intelligence Committee. We'll talk about that at the top of the show. Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court confirmation is in day one before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Republicans hope to have a decision here in a two-week period of time. The president has released his budget, which has been quite controversial. We'll talk about that. We will talk about federal judges, two of them, striking down the watered-down travel ban, and many more things that we will discuss this hour of the show. And our guest is Todd Gitlin. Todd has been here before. He's a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He contributes to BillMoyers.com. He is the author of 16 books, including The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, Occupy Nation, The Roots, The Spirit, and The Promise of Occupy Wall Street. The Bulldozer and the Big Tent, Blind Republicans, Lame Democrats, and the Recovery of American Ideals, and he is working on a novel, The Opposition. Welcoming your phone calls as we go through all of these areas of discussion and more. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, so a lot of ways for you to get a hold of us. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Todd Gitlin, hello. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi, Kathleen. Delighted to be out there with you.
Yeah, nice to have you. And we got so much to talk about. Let's start with, I couldn't hear all of it because I was preparing for the show, but let's talk about FBI Director Comey's testimony today, which is continuing. They are going pretty strong and had a late lunch. Two big news items coming from this. One is that they are investigating Russian meddling in the election, including whether or not there was any, he used the word coordination, didn't want to use the word collusion between the Trump team and Russia. And the second, when asked about whether or not, as President Trump has claimed, that President Obama wiretapped him, Comey said, "I have no information that supports these tweets." So what do you make of it so far?
Well, first thing I want to say is that it amazes me we're in an era when the FBI director feels impelled to come forward and announce the state of investigations. This is evidently now the new normal. That said, he seems to be saying something that is factual and to which neither Trump nor his acolytes could generate a convincing rebuttal. I mean, it's either there is or isn't an investigation of the connection between the Trump campaign and the hackers. He says there is. Either there is or isn't evidence of a wiretap of Trump. He says there isn't. So that moves the story forward, and I don't think this is the end of it.
How long do you think it will take for us to know the truth about all of this, Todd?
I think it may take quite some time, because at least the story about Trump campaign links to the Russians. And here, part of the story is the story is not only links to hackers, it's also linked to financial operators in Russia. This is a very intricate story. I've talked to a number of reporters who are working on it and continue to work on it. This is, even under the best of circumstances, a very high labor-intensive project to go through bank records and so on. And there are reporters working on it in a number of countries, but your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I was just hearing a talk by Jay Hamilton, who's just written a book about investigative reporting, saying the average investigative report takes 6 months of work.
Ooh.
And that's not, that would be in-house. That would be, that is to say, in-country, not involving other nations. So, you know, I'm not holding my breath waiting for outcomes. And as for the so-called wiretapping change, that's a case where, well, if there is evidence, it presumably is not deeply buried. It'll come out quickly. And as long as there isn't, then we have the president yet again doubling down on an unwarranted and foolishly deceptive claim.
Will he apologize? You've written about this, that he just doesn't back down from anything.
I don't think he apologized. I think, you know, this is an extremely weak man. I know that may seem like an oddity because he plays strong man on TV and he plays strong man in the White House, and now he actually has a lot of muscle at his disposal. But I think there's a whole lot of evidence that when it comes to facing up against opposition, his instinct is to hunker down and come out slashing. If he has apologized for anything in the past, I haven't heard it. There was that delicious moment when he summoned the press to stand around like dummies before the election at his hotel and to receive the announcement that, in fact, Barack Obama had been born in Hawaii. Did he apologize for actually building a political career on this fraudulent and, I think, essentially racist claim? Not in the slightest. The man doesn't have the largeness of spirit to apologize.
He was sending tweets, of course, during Comey's testimony, saying, let me just read a couple of them. What about all of the, and actually one of the members of the House went this direction, which was amazing. What about all of the contact with the Clinton campaign and the Russians? Also, is it true that the DNC would not let the FBI in to look? The real story, and Republicans went this way as well, and I'm wondering if you think it's justifiable, in addition to finding out what the leaks were about, the fact that there were leaks. Donald Trump wrote this morning, the real story that Congress, the FBI, and all others should be looking into is the leaking of classified information. Must find leaker now.
Well, about the DNC, you know, the fact that he said something about how the DNC has handled the Russians is, to me, somebody telling me, you know, the weather in Vermont today. I'm not there. I don't know what it is. It's certainly the fact that he made a claim about it doesn't give it the slightest truth value. If evidence materializes, it materializes. But this one is a new one out of left field. And I think it also exhibits one of his characteristic moves, which is, what about? I don't have to answer questions about what you're asking me about. I want to know about the depredations performed by my enemies. Now, I mean, this is a characteristic, defensive, projective, paranoid reaction. And this is obviously the place he immediately turns to try to wriggle away. During the campaign, he did this endlessly, dancing away from questions and spinning lies and distortions and whatabouts at such a velocity that nobody could keep up with him. Now he's continuing in the same pattern. You could run, you know, the Daily Lie as a newsletter, have it accompany every news organization's output, and you know, it'll keep you busy. So, I mean, this is simply his MO. Mm-hmm. Change the subject.
Let's talk about the lies for a moment. You've written that Richard Nixon lied about wars and cover-ups, but otherwise his evasions and spins were in the mainstream of American political discourse. He wasn't in the regular practice of calling black white. In right. The present situation, you write, a regime that systematically assaults truth is unprecedented.
Well, I agree. I agree with what I wrote. I support this message. I confirm it. It's true. I mean, I never thought I'd be. You know, I'm not a charter member of the Richard Nixon fan club. But I mean, he was in many ways a conventional president with policies that I thought were heinous. But his lies were confined to particular areas. He lied about the burglary and the cover up and. He lied about his apparatus of control centered in the White House in the so-called Plumbers Group. And he lied about the war. He lied frequently and deeply and ruinously about the war. But otherwise, he was actually a mainstream American politician. Trump is a whole different story. Trump and his lieutenants. How can we count the ways? Didn't somebody itemize several hundred lies that came out in the course of the campaign? And that was before before November 8th. So, whether it's, the size of the crowd or what he said yesterday, or what he said the day before yesterday or what somebody else said, the lies are his norm. That is unprecedented, to my knowledge.
Well, let's talk just briefly before we go into the other areas, the budget, Gorsuch, et cetera, because of what you do, professor of communication. You've written a whole lot of books. How does the press, who's best been able to talk about those lies, and how best to cover this particular administration? It must be a very difficult job for a journalist.
I think it is, and I'm somewhat privy to conversations that have been going on in news organizations about how to do it. I mean, there was a huge hue and cry during the campaign when the New York Times decided to lead with a headline using the word lie. Now, it was, as they explained, an extenuation. It was a news analysis piece, not a news report. Most readers don't make the distinction. That came out of a conversation that was overdue at the paper about how to deal with this with a pattern. How do you, you can tell a story about an incident, but how do you deal with a pattern? How do you connect dots regularly? And, of course, you're going to be accused of being prejudiced, bigoted, biased, and so on when you do it. But if you don't do it, then you've abdicated your truth mission. So some journalists began to use the word lie. Some journalists began quite early. Jake Tapper, I think, was outstanding about this on CNN when he asked Trump, I think, 23 times to clarify or deny what he had said about Judge Curiel, the judge he was up against in his so-called Trump University lawsuit. I saw George Stephanopoulos do it yesterday. I think he's acquitted himself well by talking about matters that Trump has lied about, and he recently pointed out that in another incident that Kellyanne Conway was not making any sense. You know, you have to say things like this bluntly, because otherwise you're normalizing this pathological pattern, which is a disgrace not only to a human being, but it's a disgrace to democracy. It's basically a way of showering contempt upon the people's right to know. And it's a mind scramble. It's a defeat for the process of making sense. I mean, it's an assault on reason. It's an assault on the American ideal as a republic founded in the late 18th century under the spirit of the Enlightenment, in which the cardinal rule, as was articulated by the great philosopher of the Enlightenment, Immanuel Kant, dare to know. That's what Kant wrote in a newspaper, by the way, in 1784, I believe. That was the spirit of the Enlightenment, dare to know. And so Trump has inaugurated a different phase in American life in which the hallmark is dare to fool. And what are you going to do about it anyway? So I think journalists have been called forth, and some have responded, to be what, in fact, Steve Bannon says they are, an opposition party. I myself think it's an honor at a time when lies are in power to be an opposition party. If you're not an opposition party, that is to say, if you're not in opposition to a pattern of lies, if you're not hell-bent on unearthing the lies and demonstrating that they're lies and falsehoods and distortions, you're unprofessional.
You did a piece not too long ago that took a look at Breitbart. I want to ask you about Breitbart. Has quite a few followers, and the president reads that, and obviously Steve Bannon was the head of it for some period of time. Talk about the role of Breitbart, other very right-wing organizations that are now in Sean Spicer's briefings, and the role of Fox News, because millions and millions of Americans still watch that news network. Is everybody forwarding agenda, a certain agenda, his agenda, so his believers continue to believe?
Well, he has something like 38% of the public who are indebted to him. That is to say, they don't think he's done wrong. The last poll I saw had him at 38%. That's his hardcore. Now, that's actually a lot larger than the Fox audience. I don't know whether it, if you take the overlap away and look at the sum of all the audiences of Fox News and One News, whatever it's called, and InfoWars and Breitbart and Drudge and so on, you probably don't get to 38%. So he carries with him, in part because he has this echo chamber, sort of cottage industry of amplifiers, who stoke up an unreal, outlandishly distorted and crackpot view of the world. And he seems to think that that will be sufficient. Now, I think his party, who have crawled along behind him because they found him beneficial after their less deceitful candidates flopped, they now have to decide, now that their constituents are angry about the health care change, how far are they willing to follow him down the path over the abyss? How brainless do they want to be? Now, most of them are willing to be brainless about climate change. That for them is not controversial, sad to say. But are they willing to actually stand by him when he says, for example, that the government makes up statistics, except when they don't? Are they willing to stand by him when he and his people say that, you know, that everybody's going to have great health care and nobody's going to lose it? They're tangled up here. So, how long can he play? How many times? I used to play poker, not terribly well, but I know once you're into bluffing, you gotta win once in a while. If you lose all your bluffs, you go broke. Now, of course, he's gone broke before and found entities to bail him out. I don't know who those entities would be this time.
Well, let's go to a phone call because it is applicable to healthcare. Our phone number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Todd Gitlin is our guest. He is the author of 16 books. He is on the editorial board of Dissent, contributing writer to Mother Jones, writes for Bill Moyers' blog, and is a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. Our number is 800-486-8655. Kevin in Crandon, our first caller for you, Todd. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yes, you just mentioned my topic, health care. Do you think next year, is there going to be a big backlash by all the white working class and white rural voters that voted him in when they all lose their health care? Because I'm a person that's very, very worried that I'm one of those horrible people on disability, and I'm scared to death I'm going to lose my health care. And also, one other question, does the guest believe that, is he really going to finish his whole term? I believe, I've been telling people, I think he's going to end up quitting before his head explodes.
Or before our heads explode. Well, first of all, I don't know what's coming. I don't know where the break point is. I've watched some footage of the town meetings where Republican congressmen have either run out the door to avoid facing their constituents who are angry about losing hair, or they've confronted, you know, large crowds of angry people. If I were a Republican congressman, even from a, you know, reasonably safe Republican district, I'd be asking whether right now Trump is of any value to me. I would be asking whether, in fact, I'm not paying too high a cost for my backing his budget in general and his policies in general. So, you know, at what point it'll be? I think one of the fascinating subjects over the next few months is going to sort of what to observe where the breaking points are for which members of Congress, which senators, which Republican pundits. When will they, having consulted their pollsters and their political consultants, simply say to themselves, I've had enough? And then where is Trump? Then what are his prospects for actually getting anything passed? I would say where he can exercise administrative power, he can proceed undaunted. But where he actually requires legislation, I think he's going to find himself stranded. So to your second question, can he last? There's so many events that can intrude that I don't dare hazard a guess. So many events contribute to our being in this position in the first place. I don't think any one of us a year ago would have had, among the factors that would contribute to the outcome of the election, would have enumerated as one on our list that James Comey is going to write a letter, is going to make a statement reopening a case that was never a serious criminal case in the first place.
Another area of deep concern is the budget, and we'll talk some about that. Much has been made of Meals on Wheels, but there have been a number of programs that have been cut. A huge increase, $54 billion in defense spending. We'll get our audience's take on what they think about some of the items in the budget. Neil Gorsuch having his first day of hearings today. Republicans hope to have him confirmed in a two-week period of time. Is he a mainstream conservative jurist? We'll ask Todd what he thinks about him. We'll still talk about the travel ban and what Donald Trump called the watered-down version of the travel ban that was stopped by two federal judges. And we have much more to talk about with Todd. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network.
I'm authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. As with any counterintelligence investigation, this will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed. Because it is an open, ongoing investigation and is classified, I cannot say more about what we are doing and whose conduct we are examining.
FBI Director James Comey in his hearing today, and it will continue this afternoon. We are going to be talking about James Comey and what he said for a full hour tomorrow, but feel free to bring it up this hour. I'm interested in what you think about his testimony for All Things Political. 800-486-8655 is our number. Todd Gitlin is our guest. Dan on Facebook writes this. It gets us into the budget, Todd. Voting for Donald Trump is an actual electoral atrocity. Allowing by whatever means a Trump or Ryan to come along and destroy or defund the EPA, Meals on Wheels, the National Labor Relations Board, Medicaid, Medicare, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Institutes for Health, and so much more is not acceptable, to put it mildly.
Well, my sense is that we have two kinds of cuts in the budget. Some are hurtful to many of us, whether it's Meals on Wheels or public broadcasting. But the amounts of money involved are actually, in budgetary terms, minuscule. These are symbolic attacks that are meant to excite the Republican base. We're talking about teeny amounts, and again, on the larger scale. But these are tributes to the right wing, who damned if they want to do anything for elitists, damned if they want to do anything for disabled people, damned if they want to be accused of softness. Then we have the huge cuts in agencies which need money to regulate and research. So we have the National Institutes for Health. We have the EPA, the Environmental Protection Association. We have other such agencies, the NASA, the National Oceanographic Administration, and so on. These are actual battering rams to enforce know-nothing policies about climate, to sabotage the process of science and health development. These are actual moves to implement what Steve Bannon called the deconstruction of the administrative state. You want to drown the government in a bathtub? This is how you do it. You actually unplug its functions.
You pull out one plug after a time, and the next thing you know, the government sort of starts sounding like the late lamented Howe in 2001. So they're all grave in different ways. The first are more symbolic, and the second are more material. But they all weigh into, they all contribute to the seriousness with which we have to take what it is Donald Trump intends to do to American government and life.
What are you going to do with $54 billion more dollars for defense?
Well, you're going to excite the Pentagon. There is a certain game here, a certain symbolic game, and this didn't just start with Trump. I mean, this has been true since World War II. There's a scramble for funds. The Air Force wants its toys, and the Army wants its toys, and the Marines want theirs, and the Navy wants theirs, and they'll come up with reasons, the reasons can always be made. In other words, these are political decisions, these are political judgments, they're not strictly military. The military is not itself a monolith. It's a question of who gets to show which toys in the parade. By the way, if I can just stay with this for a moment.
Sure.
In the light of the flap about Sebastian Gorka, the deputy counterterrorism guy under Bannon, I took a look over the weekend at some of his writings about counterterrorism. You'll see the relevance of this in a moment if you haven't already. So the guy who's in charge of counterintelligence says, we need a strategy for defeating al-Qaeda. Today he would say the same thing about ISIS. And does he offer one? Not in the slightest. His statements on this subject are pure banality, pure obviousness. Like, we have to destroy them. That's his strategy for destroying them. It's noise. So the promotion of a gigantic military budget is disconnected entirely from any strategy that can demonstrate that there's any point in building all this stuff except to provide some more profits to military industrial companies. So this is not only an insult to all the programs that are going to be cut, it's also completely lunatic. It has no military bearing on reality.
Well, maybe we're going to attack North Korea.
Well, that's not out of the rule, out of the running as a possibility, is it?
Let's go to Tom in Burlington next. Hi, Tom.
My father was on the Defense Committee, on the Appropriations Committee in the 1950s, Charles A. Boyle. And, well, they would decide how much money the military would have. At that time, President Eisenhower warned America about the great industrial complex. But in any organization, no matter what it is, there's a 20% and 80% rule. You get 20% of it is fat, and our budget has, we have fat and we have pork, which adds up to maybe 20%. Now he's adding on 64%, $64 billion. He could, if he really got in there with a pencil paper, he could probably get that $64 billion out of the budget and keep it on the other programs that he wants to cut. Now, here in rural America, there are a lot of people, my neighbors, they voted for Mr. Trump, and he has let them down with this budget. It's a slap in the face to them. And it's hard for them to realize that, and we have to keep pushing them in that direction, and let them know, well, these are the numbers, this is the bottom line, this is what's happening to your little community here.
Mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe that the budget as it stands will pass. Do you think it will, Todd?
Nobody thinks it will. Nobody that I read, people who pay close attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the show. Now, I'm fascinated by the last caller, and Thank you for that. I wonder what happens when you, if he's still around, talk to your neighbors, sort of those who voted for Trump or might have voted for Trump. So how are you feeling right now? Is it at all possible that you got taken, that you got conned by a master con artist who spent his entire career as a con artist?
What do your neighbors say, Tom? Are you there, Tom?
They don't care. They don't care. It goes right over them. All this conversation we're having goes right over their heads. And the more of it we have, the less they even listen. And I don't want to pile on our dear president myself, but that's what's happening. It goes right over them. And one thing I wanted to point out when I called up was, I'd like to know Mr. Trump's relationship with the editor of the National Enquirer. Because in our community, there's the National Enquirer is sitting right there at the checkout counter when you put your food on that little conveyor belt.
Yeah. Well, he wrote for it, didn't he, Todd? I don't know if he still is.
But Trump, you mean?
Yeah, didn't Trump write a column for the National Enquirer for a while?
Trump's ever written anything more than a shopping list.
He has
a gardener. I don't know anything about such a relationship, but he's spent his entire career in bed with gossip columnists. He used to call them up in New York, the tabloid editors, the New York Post, the New York Daily News, and offer them tidbits. Sometimes he disguised himself, but not very well, as somebody by another name, a PR person. He would call and brag about his sexual conquests. This is a man who's lived his whole, and this is all before The Apprentice and before television was willing to serve him up as a star. This is a man who is unscrupulous, whose narcissism knows no bounds, for whom appearing in public is what he lusts for. This is a man with no values but self-promotion.
Let's move on to Neil Gorsuch. Dianne Feinstein said that she wanted to make sure during the course of the hearings that he was a mainstream conservative jurist, whatever that means. Do you think he has any problems? Do you think he's going to be okay?
I don't know. The stuff's just coming out now. There was something I sort of glanced at earlier today about something deprecatory he said about women. I don't know. I mean, I actually agree with the Democratic senators who's saying, why are we having this very serious look at Mr. Gorsuch when the Republican Party would not give us the opportunity to have a serious look at Garland, President Obama's nominee? There's such irregularity at work here. There's such defiance of the separation of powers. There's such a kind of gangland rescinding of American tradition and constitutional values here. I don't know how to think about the particulars yet. It may be that Gorsuch is a mainstream conservative. I don't know exactly what that means now. The mainstream conservatives now like business more than labor or the public. They like unrestricted spending and politics. They like the rescinding of voting rights. If that's a mainstream Republican, a mainstream conservative, I wonder about those who think those are the values that we want to prevail in the Supreme Court.
Tom, thanks for your call. Jerry and Toma, hi.
Yes, hello. Very, very, as always, wonderful program, and hello to your guests. As I was listening, I'm black. I'm from Texas, but I live in Toma. And, you know, it's so true, even today, and it will always be, because different people that don't know about other people and have no interest in knowing them, they will have a lifetime of looking at you in that light. But it's a choice. I don't choose anymore to even acknowledge ignorance, because it's a waste of time. It's a spirit killer. Stiller. And as I spoke to your person before I came on the air, my question to her was, has anyone stepped forward to be absolutely outraged by what they are doing to, attempting to President Obama, even as much as they did to him while in office? And the stupidity of the dumbing down of this nation and to put this man where he is. You were saying this earlier, sir. It, for myself, it comes down to pure, simple hatred of a different group of people. And these mouths are on in Washington, they come and they lie and they go back and they lie some more. And then their pal declared that, hey, corporations are people too. And so they have been saying to the American public, the Republicans and those of that ilk, screw you. We don't care about you.
Thanks very much for the call, Jerry. Well, there were a couple things. Obviously, there was a play on race big time going on with the whole birther phenomena, and he said some pretty outlandish things. But there's also this element, and I wonder about this too, Todd, that people were hurting, and the Democrats weren't doing anything to help necessarily. Probably the Obama administration wasn't doing very much. Hillary Clinton was giving speeches for Goldman Sachs, making a whole lot of money. People were not paying attention to what Donald Trump identified. The question that I have is, A, is there a big element of racism in attacks against him, and even including the wiretapping charge? And B, why isn't President Obama delivering on what was one of his major promises, and that was to find jobs for people, which would make a lot of people pretty happy with him, I would think.
Well, there's a lot here. So first of all, I agree with Jerry that there's a racial animus at work here. And I also agree with him in what I think is actually a profound point, that in some way people choose their own ignorance in that they decide to be satisfied with what they already know. And much of what all of us already know or think we know is colored by our prejudices, by our emotional assumptions. In much of this country, much of the white population presumes that this is a white person's country, and if you're not white, or not what's considered white now, because those definitions change in history, then you're cutting ahead of the line. You are interfering with the right way of things. So here came the very fact that Barack Obama was elected president, and twice yet, was an insult. It was a come down. And, you know, so you still find, I forget what the latest numbers are, we still find a large proportion of Republican voters who still believe after everything we've been through for the last 10 years that Barack Obama was born in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this notion is still being promoted by some of the right-wing websites. I wrote about that a couple of weeks ago. You know, sad to say, there is going to be a proportion of the country that is evidence immune. And they're, alas, to say further, not going to go away. I mean, I think that the challenge is to peel away those people who are, you know, willing to take another look. And maybe when they discover that the administration is lying to them about their own medical care, that might conceivably, not surely, but conceivably, weaken their attachment to whatever is being promoted out of the White House. Now, as for the condition of African Americans and what Barack Obama did and didn't do, yeah, I think that he was insufficient in his contribution to creating jobs. Not nearly as much as the contrary propaganda said, because if you remember where we were in 2008 at the bottom of the Great Recession, for all the criticisms I had of his inadequate spending program at the time and so on, it did a lot of good. And but you know it's appropriate to say they didn't do enough. What is not appropriate. And it's appropriate to want to influence the Democratic Party toward taking the demands of job creation seriously. Because after all, you know, anybody who thinks that the coal mining jobs are going to come back,
right,
anybody who thinks that Michigan Steel is going to be able to outcompete
Chinese steel has been smoking something strong. That's not going to happen. And, you know, I don't think anybody really has I don't think the Democrats have an adequate response to that. I don't think Bernie Sanders did. I mean, I supported him. But I don't think he had an adequate answer. It's not just trade deals. It's trade deals and automation and de-skilling and inadequate education. So the whole series of factors. There's a lot of demagoguing that takes place. But the demagoguing is going to do the job. But as long as there's going to be a clump of the population, and right now it seems like it's in the 30%, who don't want to think about anything like that because they want to believe Trump when he says that unemployment was at 42%. I heard, he said. I heard. They want to believe that that crime is through the roof, when in fact crime has been declining for years steadily. It's more comfortable to root around in these sorts of in the swamps of nastiness than to actually face reality. That I don't think we're going to get rid of that third of that 30 some percent.
Well, what about the $1 trillion that he promised for an infrastructure program, which would give people family-supporting jobs? Aren't people waiting for him to enact that? Why is he not putting that front and center?
Because that's a fraud.
You think so?
What Trump wants to do is throw a lot of money at contractors and big companies, either to do what they're already planning to do, that is, spend money on bridges and tunnels and roads and so on, or to sock away the proceeds to buy back their own stock, to engross themselves, to pig out on the proceeds. He doesn't want to increase government spending for infrastructure. Watch very carefully if he ever gets around to promoting those measures, which I would not take for granted. Watch very closely to see where the money is going. You know, are they going to set up job centers where people can show up and get a job that's consonant with their skills, or is it simply going to be a gift to the wealthy? My money's on the latter.
Todd Gitlin is our guest. And you're listening to All Things Political, which we always have Mondays at 1 o'clock. He is professor of journalism and sociology, chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University, has written some 16 books, and is working on his 17th, which is a novel, The Opposition. Busy, busy news day. We've been starting the hour with FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, in which he said there is an investigation between possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. And he also said there is no evidence to support Donald Trump's many claims that President Obama wiretapped President Trump. And we're talking about, you know what we're talking about, the budget. What do you think of the budget? What do you think of what Comey had to say? Neil Gorsuch, would he make a fine Supreme Court justice? The travel ban, the lifting, or the two federal judges striking down the watered-down travel ban. We have yet to talk about that with Todd. So we'll be returning to your phone calls. Jerry, thanks for yours. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. Sarah in Madison, our next caller. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about whether or not it's possible or likely, or if there's any mechanism for Trump to be in any hot water legally for what seem to be his libelous claims, against former President Obama for the wiretapping, of Trump Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is you can say all kinds of things about a public person, whether verbally or on paper or on pixel, but you cannot be held guilty of libel, at least, unless you're acting with reckless disregard for the truth. You know, maybe that could be shown. I doubt that's going to get to court. I mean, there are lots of, but there are many, many legal avenues being pursued to clamp down on Trump's abuses of many kinds. There are lawsuits based on the so-called emoluments clause of the Constitution, which bars presidents from capitalizing on the donations of foreign governments. There are attempts to sue over many matters connected to procedure with respect to the travel ban. It's hard to keep up with all the lawsuits that have been filed by the ACLU and by state attorneys general who are fighting heroically on these fronts. So what's actually going to end up in court and how high up it's going to get, your guess is as good as mine. But these suits are not reported as big news when they're filed. But my understanding is that there is a lot of this activity going on. The ACLU has raised millions of dollars after Trump won the election, or whatever we want to say about what he did with the election, and they're busy.
They are busy. Well, while we're thinking about the chorus, we had two more federal judges strike down the watered-down travel ban, which to me it strikes me as quite something. You had a long time between the Ninth District decision and then the administration coming up with another travel ban that evidently they didn't have enough fine legal minds working on, because this one didn't pass legal muster either. It goes to the Supreme Court eventually, or is he just going to drop this?
You know, these people are not competent. These people are not consistent. These people are not rational. I don't put anything past them. They may just simply fold their tents and change the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll file some suits and try to get some higher paid legal help. This is really quite an extraordinary collapse of reason. So, I think when you have many legal veterans of the Bush administration who are horrified by the incompetence and wrongheadedness of Trump moves, then you know something is haywire. You know, we are not in a normal situation. Anything could happen.
Here's a message from, it's a long, long message, so let me just go to the last couple questions from Laura on Facebook. I'm so disgusted with our tax dollars sending Trump off for his holiday weekends. I think his job is 24/7, but he seems to think it's a five-day regular job. My other question is, what can I do about this? Little me, living in my little town, watching all of this going down, what can I do?
Well, think short-term and long-term. Short-term, talk to your members of Congress, talk to your state legislators and your governor, who, after all, are implementing measures, passing measures that affect the way Congress is chosen, often in anti-democratic ways. Those are all short-term things that can be done. There are many forms of resistance that people are involved in. You know, there's going to be a scientist march in Washington against the Trump people's disrespect for science. There's going to be a climate change march on April 29th, I believe. You know, a lot of this stuff going on. But in the longer term, political change is what we're talking about. You know, the Republican Party worked for years to accrue the money and the media and the conviction that power matters to take over state governments. So they control about two-thirds of them now. And opposing that is long-term work, and some of it isn't the most exciting work to do. But that's what generates and regenerates and contests power. So many things to be done, many, many things. There are groups like Indivisible and others available online who are putting people in touch with each other. You can find groups through Indivisible and other networks. I think it's indivisibleguide.com that will tell you what groups are meeting in your zip code or within 25 or 50 or 100 miles. There's actually quite an extraordinary outpouring of social energy that is committed, I think, to some degree or other, to making good on the American Republic and democracy, which are now under fire.
Todd Gitlin, thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Todd Gitlin, he is author of some 17 books, and he is a professor at Columbia University. He heads the communications PhD program there, very well known for his guide to the 60s. He is known as the 60s expert and political activist as well. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour and to Colleen Duvall for producing the show, actually, for Colleen, and also for on-air production, too. So thanks. Double duty to you, Colleen. Thank you. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We're going to be talking about climate change and the EPA, hour two of our show.